All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 40 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We are finally going to reach the point at which we will see the rise of Athenian democracy. So, we're going to see that this ancient form of government was the first time that anybody really broke through the archaic plateau on which even the Athenians were stuck, and were able to at least propose, at least imagine a different way of doing things. And democracy was not born as some sort of complete solution, as some sort of impossibly perfect arrangement right at the outset. And there were many flaws to what the Athenians created. And ultimately, some of those flaws were so debilitating and so destructive that the Athenian democracy had a reputation later on in history, in particular among the founding fathers, for those flaws. They were so glaring to the founding fathers that they spoke amongst themselves as they were arguing about how to forge a new government for the United States. And they looked back on Athens and they said, well, look at all those problems. I said, look at all these flaws and these issues, which in terms of the founding fathers thought of, especially in terms of individual rights, they would have said democracy is not a worthy solution. Nonetheless, what they would have said about it, and we'll look at some of what the founding fathers said, is they would have said, well, this at least was a humane form of government, a new kind of, a new idea that allowed human beings to rethink their politics and break through the archaic preconceptions that dominated primitive societies and which led them to be so, have a basically coercive view of each other and malevolent view of each other, and find, or at least attempt, a new way that's more benevolent towards each person, regardless of social rank, in which gives every individual an opportunity to participate, respecting that each individual possesses reason. Remember Aristotle's definition of man, the rational animal, regardless of class, right? And gives him an opportunity to participate in the state and work to define the legal apparatus that will govern that society and make it contribute an environment that will allow each individual to flourish. All of that is the hope. All of that is what tends to drive people who have a democratic outlook is that belief, which is what we inherited from the Greeks. That, in a sense, that democratic outlook, rather than the details of how the democratic system worked in Athens, because certainly it was only a city-state and it was very small and there were some strange details about that. I'm going to increase my microphone volume because I have a feeling that it was too low. But anyway, sorry about that. The details, like I said, we're gonna see. I won't even discuss too many of them because they're so specific as to be irrelevant. And that can be a real trap that people fall into when discussing the Athenian democracy, is looking at all of the mechanics of it. And pretty soon, if you get obsessed with that, you become stranded in those details. And again, you can't see the present-centric relevance. And so that would pretty much cause us to lose sight of the enormous value that we're discussing here. And so really, what we are looking for is the democratic outlook, the premise at the root of Athenian democracy, the premise that's going to animate this attempted solution to the problem of archaic government. That's what we want to pay attention to. That's what we want to use as a spur to our own thinking. Because what we're going to see is that the problem that that democracy was meant to solve still exists. The problem that democracy was meant to solve still exists. It is a universal problem of human politics. And the Founding Fathers were the best in all of history at naming this problem and at couching this problem in its proper terms. And they were also the best at solving the problem. Now, the Greeks, not quite so much. But, you know, we can't criticize them for that because they were the first. They were the heroic first movers in all of human history to tackle the problem and to try their best to solve it. So, it's in today's lecture, this is what we're looking for here. I want you to really focus as much as you can on what is the problem. I will name it for you. I'm going to guide you up into understanding what the problem is. And then I'm going to challenge you to think about democracy in light of that problem, in relation to that kind of conception of what politics is. And then see and think on your own, but then as a group, as a team here, we're also going to discuss, does it solve the problem? Does it actually do that? And perhaps we can, you know, go back and forth. And I think that we'll find that there are things that that are good about democracy and that there are things that are not. And so that is what is kind of the most productive when we're thinking about this story. All right, so to prepare, I'm going to set up the context here and I'm going to use the context that we are aware of to present the problem in terms that are as clear as can be. We're going to use the terms of the Founding Fathers. And then once we have a clear awareness of the problem, we're going to look at how democracy was designed to solve the problem. Okay, so the Archaic Plateau of Athens and how it shows us the problem. The Archaic Plateau, we already know its shape. It consists of a cycle of different forms of archaic government. A back and forth, sideways motion, I like to call it before, right? A back and forth, sideways motion that wasn't really progressive. And that sideways motion consisted of alternating between three different forms of government. Monarchy. We've talked enough about that. The ruling family, the Medontidae, and their exclusive grip on power. So we got that, and that's the base. And then, well, we have this alternate system, aristocracy, which the Eupatrid families, wresting power from the Medontidae, had said, okay, we're going to divide it up amongst ourselves, and we're going to have different archons, and we're going to divide their power, and, you know, it's going to be the different families rather than one. And, all right, so that we call that aristocracy. But basically, the thing that these two have in common is that they continue to oppress the commoners. Regardless of monarchy or aristocracy, that they were always pretty much operating the same way. They were oppressive of the commoners. And on the Archaic Plateau, the sideways motion consisted of the commoners wresting power for themselves from the aristocracy. But because they couldn't think of anything better to do, what they did was basically set up a monarchy again. Which has a strange term, right? But in a way, it's a good spur to our thinking. So the monarchy that the commoners would set up was called what? King, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Tyranny.
Yeah, right. A tyranny. The rule of a tyrannos. So the only difference between that and the traditional monarchy was, well, in the traditional monarchy, the king was chosen from a single family or from within the aristocracy and ruled on behalf of the aristocracy. Well, in the tyranny, the tyrannos would be chosen by the commoners and rule on behalf of the commoners. But notice that there's a common denominator even here. Right? It's easy to see the common denominator between monarchy and aristocracy. The aristocrats rule. It depends on how concentrated the power is. But the common denominator between tyranny and monarchy is pretty easy to see as well. It's still one group ruling through a single ruler. So we have the common denominator of a group that rules. Okay? That is a key issue. We're going to come back to that. So, in the time of Athens, we know that the commoners had finally gotten the better of the aristocrats. They had selected Pisistratus. Yesterday, we saw him at the end as their tyrannos. And they had done that because he was willing to do the one thing that Solon was not. Right? Solon had emancipated the slaves. And he had abolished debt slavery. But what was the one thing he was not willing to do in this contest between the commoners and the aristocrats, Juliet?
He didn't want to give them any more land.
Mm-hmm. In particular, take land from the aristocrats and give it to them. So that is a very specific thing. We call that redistribution. So Solon refused to enact redistribution, and therefore the compromise that he had created, as King pointed out yesterday, did not solve the core problem of the unviable nature of peasant farming in the setting of Athens. In other words, on a periodic basis, peasants would starve. And they couldn't live that way. They needed some better arrangement. And they couldn't get the aristocrats to give up their own land on behalf of the commoners. Or in some other way, perhaps by means of charity or something else, find an arrangement whereby the commoners would be cared for sufficiently in those conditions. So they were stuck. They were stuck for a solution. And they chose a tyrannos. He promised to give them more land. All right, so now we're going to see what the aristocrats did to answer that. And of course, we'll see they're still going to be stuck on this plateau that consists of one group using force to have its way against another group. And, well, finally, how do we break free of that is the question. So, as far as the details of the story of Athens are concerned, the nobility were in a tough spot because they did not have, within the city of Athens, they did not have enough power to defeat Pisistratus and the commoners. So, they had to look elsewhere. This gives the story a little its own kind of peculiar quality. And we'll connect this up to other stories soon enough here. But right, Athens is over here. This is the territory that we're talking about. Now that the nobles had lost power over this, what could they do? Well, there's all of this other part of Greece here, right, which they are connected to. We know that the Greeks had a common culture. They knew each other. And they got along in most regards, but they were independent city-states. They would have conflicts with each other, and they would have trade with each other. They had various forms of contact with each other. So what could the nobles of Athens do to regain power? Well, they came up with a clever idea. They went to this location here in Greece called Delphi. Does anybody know why they would go all the way from Athens to Delphi instead of perhaps go to some neighboring city-state immediately and ask for assistance? There's something peculiar about Delphi. Keen?
At Delphi, there was an individual called the Oracle of Delphi who was a prophecy giver.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I'm going to show you a great modern painting of the priestess at Delphi, the Oracle, as she was called. And so, Oracle of Delphi was notice what the painting. I love this painting. This painting is so such a great. John Collier is one of my favorite artists, and this is just a brilliant painting as well. You can kind of feel the cavernous quality of it, the darkness, and then just a little bit of a beam of light coming down onto her. And what's the ominous, you know, other than the darkness of the painting, what's the most ominous thing about the painting? Would you want to be sitting there? Keen, go ahead.
There's a crack opening up underneath her in the earth.
Yeah, there's a crack in the earth, and there's this smoke rising up from beneath. So, yeah, this is the scary thing in the painting. And, you know, these fumes, apparently, is a volcanic site. So these fumes apparently would induce a trance state, and lots of peoples throughout history have used some kind of inhalation in order to make themselves experience so-called visions. And people still do that today. And so, you know, this was what the oracle did. And then in this drugged state, the oracle would then speak in tongues, and it would be these strange message that was granted to whoever came. And the Greeks believed that there was a divine inspiration involved. The oracle at Delphi was dedicated to the god Apollo within the pantheon of Greek gods, and there was a serious belief that had religious significance. And so if you want to study archaic Greek religion, you're certainly welcome to do that. It doesn't have any essential bearing on the history of Greece, so we don't study it in History at Our House, but it is fascinating. And especially if you're going to study the history of art, which is just so full of Greek symbolism, it's worth it to learn about the Greek gods, Zeus and Athena and so on. And they are a fascinating bunch. And so many interesting myths and stories relate to those gods. And like I said, so much great visual art in history also pertains to those gods and what they represented in Greek culture. So very worthy pursuit in addition to studying history. Would be to study Greek mythology. It's a very fascinating subject, especially since, you know, as I said, it's archaic and it's no longer something that people take seriously. But back then they did. And this is part of what we need to do to have historical empathy. We need to understand that people would turn to the Oracle of Delphi and they would take its strange pronouncements seriously. So the nobles of Athens went to Delphi, and they bribed the oracle. They agreed to use their wealth to build a gorgeous new temple for the oracle in exchange for help in recruiting allies to retake Athens. And so when the oracle would deliver its message to people, it would include a statement at the end of its pronouncements, and it would say, "And Athens must be set free. Athens must be set free." And so when people would show up on their pilgrimages to the oracle, they would hear this message. And if they, again, were taking its pronouncements seriously, they would understand that to be a kind of command from the gods that they needed to take seriously. So having heard this message from the oracle multiple times, the king of Sparta decided that he should help the nobles of Athens to retake the city. So Sparta was a city-state down here, as you can see, on the Peloponnese, this big, almost island here. And we're going to talk about Sparta in detail next week, because the Spartans had their own peculiar form of government, unique in all of the cities, ancient city-states, and one that had some interesting features. So we're going to look at them as a contrast to Athens. But basically, for now, we don't really need to know what kind of government they had. All we need to know was that the king of Sparta was convinced by the oracle to help the Athenian nobles, which he did. So he put together an army to assist them. So with the help of the Spartans, and we're going to learn next week that they were the most accomplished military power among the Greeks, with the help of the Spartans, the Athenian nobles were able to retake Athens. So now, if we're going to be stuck on the Archaic Plateau, all that's going to happen is the aristocrats are once again going to use force to impose their will. And that looked like what it was going to happen. In 510 BC, with the help of the Spartans, the nobles took over, and they were going to reinstitute a monarchy. There were various factions within the aristocrats, and they were going to choose a prominent family and a leader to be a new king. And so probably, when we're talking about a new king, we're still talking about a fairly aristocratic arrangement, but it doesn't matter, right? All we're talking about here is the aristocrats were going to take power again for themselves and select somebody to be the leader of that power group. And so we're going to end up back in the cycle again, right? They would enact revenge. They would use power to get their land back and to reassert themselves, which would at some point only lead the commoners to do the same back and forth in a vicious cycle. So, things were not going in any progressive direction at this point, because at this level, and now I'm going to use, already used the word inadvertently, but I can't help myself. Now I'm going to use the word that the founding fathers used to describe this problem, to describe what was going on in essence in Athens, in Athenian politics. The founding fathers called the problem that Athens had, the problem of faction. The problem of faction. And James Madison was the most adept at discussing this problem. And we look at this in great detail in American history. In his argument for creating a republic, is known as Federalist Number 10. And I've already made reference to this, because earlier in the year we were talking about the definition of a republic, and I wanted to make sure that you understood that the statements that James Madison makes in Federalist Number 10 are not entirely definitional by themselves, in especially that the idea of representation in a republic is not the essence. The essence is what he's discussing in Federalist Number 10 is the same problem that the Greeks had, which is the problem of faction. So we might do some more detailed reading of this together in class here, but I want somebody to read here what James Madison said, which will be very revealing of what you've already said. You'll be able to see with the clarity here that this grants us with regard to the situation in Athens. So just the segment in blue, Abby, make sure that you read it slowly, you know, err on the side of being slow and enunciate really, really clearly for us, please. And everybody else can follow along.
By faction, I understand a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or a minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse or passion, or of interest adverse to the rights of other citizens, or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community.
Okay, good. So, in essence, a faction is a what? A faction is a what? What's another way of saying a number of citizens? Whether a majority or a minority. What's another way of saying that? Keen?
group.
A group. Okay? Right. A faction is a group within a community. That does what? What is it that defines it? A faction is a political group, though. Okay? It's not a sports team. Right? That's a group, too. Right? That formed for a certain purpose. Right? Recreational purpose. It's not a band, which is formed for a different kind of purpose. Right? A faction is a certain kind of group. What is it? It's a group. What does this mean? That is united and actuated by a common impulse of passion or of interest. That's a pretty wordy phrase there, and not easy to decipher. What does it mean? What would we say about the aristocracy as a faction? What is its impulse of passion or of interest? Keen?
So, united and actuated would be... Well, united is self-evident. Actuated would be motivated or driven to action. And as far as the aristocracies, they're what they were united by and driven by would be to keep their power, keep their land, and keep their, I want to say rights, but they didn't have that idea, to keep their individual...
It's good that you're struggling with that phrase there, because you're right that they did not have the word rights. So this is what the founding fathers have that the Greeks didn't have. But they do have an interest that is adverse to the rights of the other citizens. Right? In the sense that the commoners could go into debt slavery or they could starve. Right? And so that political power of the laws of Athens was such that it was prejudicial to the rights of the commoners. So adverse, in other words, against, okay, damaging to the rights of other citizens. So again, like Keen says, the Greeks didn't have the concept of individual rights. But they would have understood, and Cleisthenes, who's going to be the architect of this new transformation we're going to see here, would say, yeah, the aristocrats have a way of running the government that favors them at the expense of others, using political power. Now, here's the problem. When the commoners come in and they put a tyrannos in power, what do? What do they do any different? Abby?
Once their tyrannos is in power, they're not gonna do anything different than what the aristocrats did.
Yeah, they're the majority, but they behave the same way. Right? So the minority in Athens would be the aristocrats, the majority would be the commoners, but it doesn't matter. See, James Madison says, whether amounting to a majority or a minority, doesn't matter. What happens is the group acts on behalf of the group. That is a faction. And, well, it's going to be interesting because James Madison is later in Federalist Number 10 is going to tackle this problem. And it's going to be part of his argument for creating a republic that it's the best way to overcome this problem of faction. And he was discussing it because America was divided into factions too. And continued to be, and, well, sadly continues to be. And so, in fact, James Madison recognized that the problem of faction is a permanent problem of politics. It never goes away. And it should be clear enough, right? Because you have two very large factions in American politics today, along with all kinds of subdivisions and smaller factions of various groups that are actuated by a common interest, which try to control the two main factions. But in modern politics, we call them political parties, right? And so the Republicans are one faction, huge faction. Then the Democrats are another huge faction. And then we have all kinds of other factions in modern society. Some people complain about the faction of big business and how it uses money to influence politics. There are other kinds of factions that lobby, so-called, that are lobbies that influence the government. Some of them come from different countries. Some of them represent religions. Some of them represent sects within a religion. Some of them represent different kinds of interest group, like environmentalists and so on. And so this is, James Madison understood, this is a permanent problem. And that how do you, given that human beings work together in groups, necessarily, human beings are social animals, and they conspire in groups to do various things, sometimes benevolent, sometimes not, right? But the thing is, in politics, they will get together in groups and club each other over the head with that group power if they can. Sadly, they will. And it's so tempting to do it because you don't want to be on the losing side. And so in a democracy, that ends up being the majority. But here's the problem of faction. And Cleisthenes, looking at Athens, saw that problem. Not with the clarity of James Madison, but he nonetheless saw the problem. The aristocrats as a group ruling over the commoners, using the government, using the power of the government to enforce unjust institutions like debt slavery, and keeping them in a privileged position, which was really oppressive to the commoners. Whether you could claim that, you know, the rules were the rules and the laws are the laws and they have a right to property and so on, you couldn't deny that the arrangement was abusive of power. On the other hand, though, when the commoners got hold of power, well, all they did was turn the tables. Right? What they did was use force to redistribute property, and doing so in a manner, well, that was against the property rights of the aristocrats. Again, they didn't have that phrase, but necessarily the aristocrats would view that as unjust. So how do you break this deadlock, right? How do you break this archaic cycle, a vicious cycle? Each group, once it becomes the leading group in power, uses that power to oppress the other group. And then, well, the other group rises up to power and uses the power to oppress the other group. And back and forth and back and forth. At some juncture, this falls apart, right? You cannot continue to have a society divided against itself because, well, at some point, there's somebody looking in over the fence, right, that says, hey, look at those people divided against themselves and is ready to take advantage of it, and that society gets wiped out. So, how to overcome the problem of these political divisions? Well, we have a character named Cleisthenes who is going to originate a new type of arrangement. He is the father of Athenian democracy. He is the inventor. And what he's going to do is, he's going to try to break the groups. He's going to try to break the factions. What are the factions? They're the aristocratic faction and they are the commoners. Okay, how can you break those? Well, his idea is interesting. He decided that we're going to have to reshape the Athenian government so that it's divided up into new groups, not the traditional ones, but new groups that include people from each of the old groups, to force them to rethink how they act in politics. The new groups were called demes. So this, in fact, is the root word of democracy. It's related to the word demos. And it's an interesting idea. A deme was a suburb or a subdivision of Athens. They were subdivisions of land. And basically, what each person who lived within a certain region was enrolled, as it says here, in the citizen lists of the deme, and thus participated in politics as a member of the deme, not as a member of any class. Not as a member of the aristocracy, not as a member of the commoners or any subdivision thereof, but simply as a citizen of a certain geographical area. So what was the point? What's interesting about that? I mean, it is, in some ways, it seems so... There are some obvious similarities to the way things are done now, right? Because when we think about democracy, we think of very much the same sort of arrangement. People are in certain geographical areas. When you get a bunch of them in a certain area, well, they vote in that area. And then if we think about the entire country, like the United States of America, well, each state is divided up. We don't call them demes now, but we have different terms, counties or townships and different types of terms in different places, but they all amount to the same thing, a certain geographical area. And it doesn't matter what group you might think of yourself as belonging to, that is that all those sorts of distinctions are wiped out. And instead, you as an individual participate as a citizen, which means as a single person, and you vote. And so in Athens, you as an individual were a member of a deme. And thus on a rotating basis, you would be sent by the deme to represent the deme, not to represent your class. And then in the assembly, in the central assembly, the individuals would then propose laws, and individuals would argue for or against the laws, and each individual, regardless of rank, simply as a citizen, would vote. So that's what we call democracy. Right? So you can see that democracy was designed by Cleisthenes, using the terms that the Founding Fathers helped give us and which clarified the problem, as a solution to the problem of faction, as a way to lift Athens out of the archaic plateau of simply alternating between factions in power that use power against each other. So, Nemo says, how do you spell what, Nemo? Raise your hand, that's always better. Let's see here. How do you spell what?
Cleisthenes.
Cleisthenes. Oh, well, okay, let's go back here to Cleisthenes. Different spellings. I use this one, but you can spell it a bunch of different ways. Right? So, but that basically was the concept, to break up traditional loyalties, to force people to rethink their participation in government and get them to do it more individually, less in terms of factions. Well, did it work? We'll look at some of the interesting features of how democracy evolved over time. Evidently, the Founding Fathers did not view it very highly. The story of Athens is very tumultuous. What we can attribute to democracy and so on versus other factors is not easy to do. And it's not that crucial to judge it this way or that way in terms of its historical performance. Like I said at the beginning, what's the most important thing about this? The most important thing is what we would call the democratic outlook. which is the idea that citizens should participate in popular government, that they are worthy of doing that, and that the government should be, in the words of Abraham Lincoln, right, by the people, of the people, and for the people, rather than, and the people here, we're talking about everybody collectively working together, as opposed to some group having power over others because of some traditional association that they have, especially aristocracy, where they see themselves as superior to everybody else. In a democratic society, people think more of each person as worthy of participating individually. That's the democratic outlook. Does it solve the problem of faction? Unfortunately, it tends to create other factions. It creates new factions. It creates a whole other set of problems at the same time as it might be solving others, which is why the Founding Fathers did not choose democracy when they created the United States. That they saw as clearly as could be that, no, democracy leads to its own factional issues, its own factional problems. So we'll look at some of what they were drawing upon in Athenian history in the coming weeks here. We'll see that Athens did have problems with democracy, and we'll look at some of the specifics of that as we get through the story. First, what we're going to do, though, is we're going to turn to Sparta as an alternative. And then we'll see that one of the problems that Athens had with democracy was, how do you wage war in a democracy? And what are the stresses that the need to wage war as a state, what does that do to a democracy? That's also something that Americans are struggling with, and a very interesting problem. And what factions does that create? And how does that lead to people kind of being at each other's throats as well, is a really difficult problem. But anyway, at least this now is, you know, we've gone up from that basic set of alternatives, the archaic alternatives, and we have a new one, right? A new thing to think about, and a new challenge for individuals to participate in government. That's the progressive component. Thoughts or questions, comments about this Athenian democracy? All right, well, as you look around at America today, use the clarifying principles of James Madison to see the society you live in more clearly. Look for the factions. Look at how people are divided by their group associations and how they cannot see each other benevolently. Because of that, how it is that in essence, group associations always divide human beings. And what are they? There are many different kinds. We'll talk about them more because this is where it's at. Right? I mean, if we're going to talk about democracy, if we're going to talk about the value of it and talk about the dangers of it, it doesn't get more important than what people are voting on today. It doesn't get more important than how do modern democracies function and what do they reveal about this concept. It goes back to the Greeks, and their experience tells us a lot, but ultimately, we got to tie it back to where we are. What are the factions? What are the groups that want to use the government as a club against other groups? Sadly, there's a lot of them. But think of it in those terms. And then, what about rights? Why did the Founding Fathers not choose democracy to to make the government. How does the government work? Even if you or your parents are going to vote, right? What is it that they can't do? Or what is it that limits what they can and can't do through voting in our society? And how does that work? Why? So on. That's the ultimate thing, where the power of history here is to spur our thinking about these difficult questions. Because if we don't think about these difficult questions, then essentially we are drifting through, and as citizens, potentially enacting force against each other in a profoundly malevolent way, and that makes us no better than the archaic Egyptians or the archaic Persians, and we're not being the modern, superior people that we want to be. More civilized, rights-respecting people that we should want to be. All right. Food for thought. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.